From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, playing politics with road repair dollars?
Of the 108 road projects that were approved for special one-time funding of $115 million last year, 106 of 108 projects were requested by a Republican.
We explore why there isn't a country in the world where women and girls are equal to men and boys.
It seems to me that men like the idea of saying, yes, we're all equal, but actually when it comes to making changes to how their society and how their lives are organized, perhaps we're not so keen on that.
Graffiti, urban blight, or vibrant street art?
You know, it's everywhere. It's used in advertising, and it's become a respected art form.
We have those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Graffiti. It takes up walls and bridges, buildings and alleys throughout Michigan's cities. There are advocates who say it's art, it's a sign of revival. And there are critics who say it's blight, it's a nuisance. On today's Stateside, is there a middle ground and who gets to decide? I'm Cynthia Canty. Also this hour on opening day for the Detroit Tigers, an opening day poem read every year by the voice of Tigers baseball, the late Ernie Harwell. But first, state lawmakers like to tell us there are no Republican roads, no Democrat roads when they talk about Michigan's battered roads and bridges. Battered to the point where Republican Governor Rick Snyder wants more than $1 billion a year in additional road funding. But Chris Gouts, Capitol correspondent for Crane's Detroit Business, has been digging into that statement and wondering if it's so very true, especially when it comes to the funding of road repairs. Chris, do we indeed have Democrat roads and Republican roads in Michigan?
It would appear that the case that yes, we do, in fact, have Republican roads and Democrat roads.
Now, you went through a project list by the Michigan Department of Transportation, and it spelled out which projects were approved by the, we should note, Republican-led House and Republican-led Senate and Governor Snyder. What did you find?
Well, we found that of the 108 road projects that were approved for special one-time funding of $115 million last year, 106 of 108 projects were requested by a Republican.
Well.
two from Democrats. They got two, which some people actually find amazing. They actually got two.
They actually did a little better with the governor, didn't they? Democrats did.
Yeah. When the administration put in its sole requests, there were 19 projects, I believe, that came from the administration. And 12 of those had part of the district or part of the road included a Democratic district. So, but only two of them were actually requested by Democrats. There were 20 of the 108 in total that the road or bridge that was being repaired fell into some part of a Democrat's district. But most often the case was that it was a Democratic district, but it was a Republican, maybe a senator, that requested it. And their districts are so large that it just sort of overlapped. And that's why you got the 20.
Now, doesn't MDOT keep a five-year wish list of projects that one might think would be based on the condition of the roads and not the politics of whose district they're in?
They absolutely do, and so when and the money that was that was announced last year, this was a very new thing. It had been about a decade or so before lawmakers gave themselves a pot of money to disperse, and with the creation of, you know, so-called pork projects like this. And so when this was announced, MDOT said, you know, if we're going to do this, we have a five-year list. So any money that you're going to use for state roads, just take it right off the top of this list, and then we can just update and we can add a year to our five-year plan, and we can get these projects going.
Sounds
They're
good.
Already vetted and ready to go. They did that, I think, in about a dozen cases, but there were 30 projects that Republican lawmakers requested last year that were not on MDOT's five-year plan. And so some of them, you know, they didn't follow MDOT's guidance completely on this.
And House Democrats were not invited to be part of the party when lawmakers allocated special funding for road projects that they wanted to control. How did House Democrats get left out off the table?
Well, they just didn't get an invitation to the party when it comes down to it. This money was talked about last spring, and then it was included into the state budget. But when they were starting to gather the lists among House Republicans, House Democrats were not informed of that. I was told this week that was because Republicans just took a hard stance on this one, and they said, you know what, Democrats didn't vote for the funding for this money, so we're not going to give them a chance to apply to receive any of it.
And all of that had to do with a lot of other issues having nothing to do with roads, right? When Democrats were looking at the issue of funding for Medicaid expansion and a cut to revenue sharing.
Yeah, absolutely. It wasn't like Republicans decided to put up a bill that just had $115 million of road money, and Democrats said, no, we don't want road money. This money was included in the overall, what they call, omnibus state budget bill. And so Democrats, by and large, voted against that bill because, like you said, it didn't include the money for Medicaid expansion.
Right.
Democrats will say it cut education funding, so they were never going to vote for it. So they didn't vote for it because there was more money for roads. They voted for it for a number of other reasons, but that's because of that. Republicans didn't let them have any say. So I think it was ended up being 56 out of 59 House Republicans got a road project completed or got funding for a project in their district, while zero House Democrats got any requests approved.
We're talking with Chris Gouds, who's capital correspondent for Crain's Detroit Business. So let's stretch our imaginations just a little bit, Chris. If the shoe was planted on the proverbial other foot and the Democrats were in charge the way the Republicans are now, would the same thing happen, do you think?
Well, it's hard to say, but you know, history has proven in many cases when things happen like this, whether it's, you know, the dust up over immediate effect that we saw in the last couple of years, whenever the other side's in power, they claim that the other side did it to them first, which is no way for adults to act. But we're talking about politicians here. We're not talking about adults always in every case. And so there have been so many instances. So, yes, I'm sure that you can make the argument that if the shoe was on the other foot, maybe the same thing would have happened. But we're talking about this shoe.
This is true right now. And so here we have state lawmakers getting ready to decide where to spend that $115 million special allocation for road and bridge projects. What do you hear from both sides of the aisle?
What I'm hearing is that, at least on the Republican side, that this time will be a little different, maybe because they don't think they can, quote-unquote, get away with another 106 to 108 record. But they also say that this time around, the Democrats actually voted for the funding because this money, this new pot of $115 million, which will be decided upon by the Republican leaders in the next couple of weeks, which projects get funding, that money was included in the supplemental funding bill that was voted on a few weeks ago that the Democrats did support. So they said, you know what, we're going to let them come in. And according to my reporting, the House Democrats have included about 100 projects for consideration. So there is hope, although, you know, Representative Kandrivas on the Democrat side, who's been in charge of this in their caucus, so to speak, has said, you know, don't get ready. He's told his members, you know, don't, you know, get out the big scissors and think there's going to be some big ribbon cutting. You know, I don't have any promises, but it sounds like they're going to try to be a little more fair this time.
How do you think this is going to play into 2014 election politics?
It's tough to say. I'm sure that this could be something that Democrats will use to say that, you know, the Republicans are overreaching, you know, they're power hungry or whatever the case may be. But and then you could also see some Republican members saying, you know, look what I did. You know, when this money was announced back like a week before Christmas, all the Republicans and some Democrats who got a part of the money in their district put out press releases saying, you know, I secured this money for, you know, for this road project, and this is going to get done, and this is going to get done. And so while the money was approved last December, obviously no work gets done right now. So all of the money, the $115 million, all those projects are going to start getting shovels in the ground in the next weeks and months. So you're going to see those now. And then when the new $115 million worth of projects get announced before July 1st, then all of those will start to happen. So you're going to see all sorts of construction barrels, primarily as right now in Republican districts, all throughout the summer months leading into the election. So to the extent that your vote can be swayed because the road in front of your house or your office got fixed, maybe it does have an impact. I don't know, though. We talked to Rick Johnson, the former House Speaker, and he said if anybody thinks that they're going to get elected because they got a road project, they really got another thing coming. You've got to get out there and knock on doors and do the things that your constituents want, not just bring home a pork project or two.
That's and yeah, I loved his quote, actually. Actually got a little blunt talking there.
yes, he did. You can be when you're not the House Speaker anymore.
That's right. But if you're a driver and you don't really care who's on what side of the aisle, and you are clattering down the road in a district represented by a Democrat, and you've blown your tire or you've bent your rim, too bad for you?
Well, I suppose, you know, when I talk with Representative Verhulen, the Republican that's the chair of the Appropriations Subcommittee for Transportation, you know, he pointed out, you know, he's from Kent County. And so when he drives from Kent County to the Capitol, he drives through all sorts of districts that are Democrat and Republican. And, you know, so it doesn't, you know, fixing one area over the other doesn't benefit anyone. And so he seems to be very earnest in wanting to, you know, bring together as many good projects as possible. But when it's the leadership that's making these choices, you know, he gets dropped out of that discussion. He wants to be more involved this time around. Hmm. So we'll see if those views will be inserted into the dialogue this time, where you'll see more of a balance, which is definitely what he wants to see going forward. But yeah, like you said, yeah, you're going to drive through all sorts of roads. But this time around, when, I mean, it should come as no surprise when Republicans decide how big the pot of money is going to be, and they decide who gets to request projects, and then they get to decide which ones get approved. It shouldn't come to surprise anyone that almost 98% of their projects went to Republicans.
Chris Gouts, Capitol correspondent for Crane's Detroit Business, is always keeping an eye on things in Lansing Forest. Good talking with you, Chris. Thanks.
Thank you.
This is Tiger Opening Day. And here's the late Ernie Harwell, beloved voice of the Detroit Tigers for 42 years.
Lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of the singing of birds is come, and the voice of the turtle is heard in our land.
The man known as the voice of Tiger baseball would open every season reciting Song of the Turtle, celebrating spring and renewed life and opportunities. And for Tigers fans around the world, it just wasn't opening day without hearing Ernie Harwell speak those words. In memory of the late sportscaster, here's Michigan writer Terry Wooten reading his poem titled Old Ernie Harwell.
Over 5,000 Detroit Tiger ball games ago, Grandpa took me trout fishing in the old Butterfield Creek. On the way home, half asleep, I listened to Ernie Harwell recite the late innings of a Tiger ball game while Grandpa's cigarette glowed like a campfire in the dark. Outside the car windows, Michigan floated along. I felt content as young trout snuggled under a log in the current. Since that night, only thing on the radio that rivaled rock and roll or country and western music is Ernie Harwell, going on and on like an epic poem full of Ty Cobb trivia and Detroit Tiger history. Like a human baseball encyclopedia, always sounding the same, but always different through three decades of most of the incarnations of my life. I even proposed to my wife with Ernie crooning in the background. Or was it the Rolling Stones song, Time Waits for No One? That was over 2,000 Tiger games ago. Grandpa's been gone since 1979. Late that last September, he whispered, "Psst, I've got a secret. I'm dying." Then he sat there like an old house beside the road and watched life go by like a Denny McClain fastball. There isn't any real security, but Ernie Harwell and airwaves came close.
That was writer Terry Wooten. He's the founder of the Stone Circle gatherings that run from mid-June until Labor Day weekend near Elk Rapids. We often talk about the United States as being the land of opportunity, that here's the country to fulfill your dreams. That's certainly the view of America from many other countries. But is that view really justified? Here in Michigan, one in four kids live in poverty. And are girls in Michigan really seen as equal to boys? We may say, of course they are. But does that belief hold up to close scrutiny? The BBC's Roz Atkins wanted to discover if there's any place in the world where girls and women are treated the same as boys and men. He's produced a documentary tracing the lives of four girls in four different countries. It's called All That Stands in the Way. We'll get Roz's perspective on this. And we bring in Dustin Dwyer from Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity Project about how we talk about the American dream as this big, grand idea, which may not work out that way in reality. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, Cynthia.
Roz, I want to start with you looking at the global level. You explore the lives of four teenage girls and tell us where they're growing up.
So I visited four girls. Vigdis in Iceland's 15. We went to Reykjavik. Lulu is 16. She lives in southeast London, very close to where I live. Shwe Shwe is 16 and lives in Maseru, which is the capital of Lesotho, a very small country which is completely surrounded by South Africa. And Mira is 15 and she lives in Amman in Jordan. So those are the four girls that I visited. And the reason I went to see them was that sometimes I feel the way that gender equality or inequality is approached is always through numbers. We look at the number of women or girls who are able to do this versus the number of boys or men who can do something. And of course, that has value, but there's often an emphasis on legislation and education. And what I was interested in was the fact that actually lots of countries in the world have legislation which say you can't discriminate according to gender. Mm-hmm. Lots and lots of countries have education systems which treat boys and girls essentially the same. And yet we don't have a single country in the world where if you look at the data, you can say that men and women, boys and girls are equal. So I thought, well, maybe I need to understand the cultural and social exchanges which make up a woman or a girl's life in order to really understand the roots of inequality. And so that's what I did. I recorded the lives of these four girls and the time they spend with their friends and family and their teachers to try and see where that inequality begins.
And what comparisons and commonalities were you able to draw among the girls in these very disparate nations?
Well, I kept having these moments, Cynthia, where I would be thinking, my goodness, I am a long way away from London, for instance, or I'm a long way away from Reykjavik, where we went first, and yet I'm hearing exactly the same thing from a girl the same age. So, for instance, the issue of being able to speak up and express your opinion without being judged was raised by all four of them. They all had stories of how, in the classroom, if a girl expresses an opinion in a forthright way, she's seen as being bossy or having an attitude, whereas if a boy does it, he's seen as having confidence and leadership skills. They said they sometimes had issues within their families also about expressing opinions and felt that boys would be judged differently if they did the same. So that came out a great deal. And then the other one, which they all mentioned, was this idea that girls need to be protected in their very different ways. They all said they felt that their family and their teachers and society wanted to treat them differently to boys because they required more protection. They were, to use the phrase a dad used in Jordan, they were more cute, they were more precious. And all four of them said, forget this, treat us exactly the same as boys.
And Dustin, I found it interesting that when Roz asked teenage girls in London, who's a female role model that you can look at and think, well, here's an example of what I could be, they mentioned Beyonce and Oprah. And it just kind of supports that belief that I think to much of the world, the United States is where you can get your shot and all the opportunities in the world are there for the taking. But as you've seen in your reporting for State of Opportunity, that's certainly not the case.
Yeah, well, maybe it's nice that people around the world still think of the United States that way. But to get back into some of the numbers, the numbers don't really support that idea that the United States is an exceptional land of opportunity. If you look at how the economic fate of a child turns out compared to their parents, the United States is not really any better of a place than many other countries around the world. It's not truly exceptional.
I was at a theatre group in southeast London with Lulu and some of her friends, and I was saying to them, so who are your role models? Who inspires you? And as you've mentioned, Cynthia, they mentioned Beyonce. And I said, but hold on, what about successful female politicians? And first of all, they gave me blank faces and they said, we can't really think of any. And I said, well, you can't think of any politicians. And in the end, one of them went, Michelle Obama. And I kind of paused and thought, hold on, that's the wife of a politician. That's not even an elected politician. And a number of times I was with groups of girls in different countries and said, can you name me one successful female politician? And they couldn't. And then you kind of listen to that and you think, well, perhaps it's no surprise that a lot of women think politics isn't for them.
That is interesting. And we certainly know there is a decided underrepresentation of women in Michigan's legislature. Dustin, as you do your reporting for State of Opportunity, can you give us a sense of the differences you see in the way girls in Michigan are treated as they grow up strictly because of their gender?
There clearly is a difference. And I think Roz is onto something in that the differences are really more social, because when I look at the numbers, I did a documentary last year called Be a Man. And it was all about how girls in the United States are actually outperforming boys in terms of academics. Girls in the United States score better on many test measures through kindergarten through 12th grade. Females in the United States earn many more bachelor's degrees than males. Females outperform males in earning advanced degrees such as master's and PhDs. And yet, despite this incredible academic performance, we still have a wage gap in the workplace. So what you see is I think that even when females succeed and do really well, they still don't earn the same things as men. And I think the roots of that are probably social.
And one of the interesting things, Dustin, was when I was in this playground in Maseru in Lesotho, and this group of girls and boys were talking, and I was pointing out to them that literacy rates among women are higher than they are among men. Women pick up more white-collar jobs in Lesotho now than men do. So in many ways, they're doing well. But I said to these young lads, what would you think about having a wife who earns more than you? And they looked absolutely horrified and they went, no way. I don't mind women being successful, but there's no way my wife can earn more than me. What would my role in the family be? And it became clear, and it was like a moment for me where I realized that when we talk about equality, it's not just about women's roles changing, it's about men's roles changing as well. And until we put a lot of effort into thinking about how that's going to work, it seems to me that men like the idea of saying, yes, we're all equal, but actually when it comes to making changes to how their society and how their lives are organized, perhaps we're not so keen on that. And you're quite right that in lots of countries, girls and women outperform in education, but then in the workplace, where perhaps it comes down to attitudes as well as achievements, it starts going wrong.
And those attitudes are starting as those boys are growing up, so they're soaking that up from their parents, whether the parents think so or not.
Well, I guess they are soaking up some attitudes from their parents. I didn't come across any parents who were saying, look, you mustn't encourage girls to be successful. I think it's more that, and this came out in a lot of conversations I had in Iceland with Vigdis and her family, that some countries are evolving their idea of what women can do in the workplace. Certainly that's happening in Iceland, but they're not evolving their idea of what women should be at home. So Vigdis was saying to me, I'm feeling this pressure because Iceland wants women to do as well in the workplace as men, and to some degree that is possible, but it hasn't changed what it's expecting of me as a mother and as a wife. And so I'm feeling a pressure to succeed in two areas, while that pressure doesn't really exist for boys and young men.
And could that, I'll throw this out to both of you, because I know you're both fathers, is that some of that or a large part of that based in basic biology? It's the girls who will bear the children, the women who will bear the children. So is some of that sense of protectiveness, and when that father in Jordan said, well, they're precious, is that what they're talking about? Is it biology?
People use that excuse quite a lot, but I'm not sure that determines that's something that has to be the way it is. You may know in my own personal work history, when my daughter was born, I quit my job and I was the one who stayed home. And we see that shift happening more and more in many countries. But one thing I'll add is that to the point Roz was making, the attitude shift is very, you can sense very much a socioeconomic divide in this area, because when I report on families who are in poverty in the United States, kids who are in poverty, they face very different gender expectations than the kids whose parents have college degrees and who have white collar jobs. Those families who have upper income and who are educated are more likely to tell their kids, regardless of gender, you can be what you want, you can do what you want. Whereas if you're growing up in a rural community in Michigan, or if you're growing up in a neighborhood in poverty in one of our cities, the gender roles are much more what we might think of as old fashioned.
I'm listening to this and I'm thinking of an interesting discussion I had, and it's in the documentary where I'm walking along through one of the main markets in Maseru in Lesotho with the mother of Shwe Shwe. She's called Masikonyana, and she was saying to me, the thing is that it's a woman's role to be a mother. That's why she's on earth. That's why she can nurture a child better than a man can. And I, you know, in a friendly way said to her, look, I'm bristling a bit when you're saying this, because I know I can't breastfeed a baby, but I'm not clear why I can't do everything else. And she said, well, I just think that it's within women to do it in a different way. And I just don't feel that. And I feel like societies that I know, these four that I've visited, but particularly in the UK, has a long, long way to go in terms of how it sees the roles that men and women perform. But I just don't buy the argument that something biological is preventing us from doing it right. But I would add, and I'm listening to you, Dusty, and feeling slightly ashamed, actually, because you know, it's one thing to say you believe in equality, but actually when push came to shove, when we first had children, when our daughter Alice was born, you know, for me to have given up my job, I think I would have found that really, really tough to do. And I didn't do it. My wife did it for a while. And when it came down to it, I didn't quite make those brave choices. And I think that's one of the points I'm trying to get across in this documentary. Is not, it's not a lecture from me to the rest of the world. I'm not getting it right either. But I do think that in the personal decisions we all take and how we organise our families, we could change this, because it's not necessarily about laws and education. It's about making tough decisions that go against the social norm. And they are tough to take, and I failed to take some of them myself. But if we did take them, the problem would get fixed.
If you just joined us, that was the BBC's Ross Atkins, who has produced a special hour-long documentary tracing the lives of four girls in four different countries. It's called All That Stands in the Way. And he's joined by Dustin Dwyer from Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity Project as we look at what it will take to make the playing field level for girls. Do you think you started to go in this, Roz? Is this economic? Is this a cultural shift? Or is it all of the above that's needed to really put girls on an equal footing?
Well, clearly at the moment, men have more economic power than women, and that's going to give them a huge advantage. They have more political power too. In fact, everywhere you look in societies, any society in the world, everything is stacked against women, and it's going to take an awful lot of changes to rectify that. But what has really shocked me making this program is the extent to which we have all accepted this inequality. It's become normal. Mm. For instance, if you take racism, in the UK in the last 25 years, racism has become totally unacceptable. You can't make a racist joke in the pub. If someone said it at school, you'd be in serious trouble. It just has become completely unacceptable. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but it's become socially unacceptable. Sexism isn't unacceptable. The girls I spent time with told me endless stories of comments that if they'd been made about a black person or an Asian person, it would have caused a serious incident in the classroom. But you make it about girls and somehow it's okay. And so for me, reversing the normalization of this inequality is the crucial thing. And the only way I can see to fix this, and Dusty may have a different view on this, but the only way I can see to fix this is in the thousands of decisions and reactions that we have to situations we're in. We have to do things differently. We have to point out when, for instance, as a news journalist, when we're covering a story and all of the protagonists are men, don't make that normal. Don't make that something you don't comment on. Actually point it out, because a lot of this inequality and a lot of this sexism is in plain sight. We've just gotten so used to it, no one points a finger at it and says, hold on, that's not all right.
Yeah, and I think to some of the stuff that I've reported on the past year, I think it's also important to say that a big part of this is how we raise our boys and the types of expectations we put on them. Because as Roz said, I think most people can identify that it might be perfectly socially acceptable in a group full of all men to hear some very sexist comments. And I, along with some of my other male friends, have had experiences of being uncomfortable in scenarios where people around us were making sexist comments and it was just totally normalized. And I think that goes to the expectations that men are given as they're raised from a very young age, that men are a certain thing and women are a certain other thing, and these are just the ways that we're going to behave for the rest of our lives. And I think the more that we can raise our kids in school environments and in home environments to just sort of be themselves and not be sort of actors in a play about gender, the better our kids will turn out.
I do sense that there is a movement in the UK, particularly at the moment, where a lot of women and girls are saying, actually, this wasn't fixed 25 years ago when feminism had its, you know, first major wave. This wasn't fixed. This still requires a lot of work, and we're not going to put up with it. And I think in some ways I feel excited for my girls to have the chance to take that on, because as the mother of Vigdis in Iceland said, you know, I thought we had this fixed, but we don't. And we're now relying on the next generation to take this on. So I guess that's a challenge for my girls, but I wish they didn't have to take it on.
Interesting conversation. Roz Atkins of the BBC. His documentary is called All That Stands in the Way. And he was joined by Dustin Dwyer, who, of course, is with Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity Project. Thank you so much to both of you. It was really a great conversation. Enjoyed it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
It is no overstatement to say that property tax revenues are the lifeblood of local government. So what do local leaders think about the tax-exempt properties within their borders, the ones that take up municipal services but are exempt from paying taxes, like religious institutions and schools? Well, the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy, CLOSUP, at the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan, has made that the central question of its latest Michigan Public Policy Survey. And program manager Tom Evacco joins us now. So why look at this question, Tom?
Well, there's evidence that these kinds of properties are becoming more common across the nation. We've seen other reports that say that growth of tax-exempt properties are happening much more frequently in the last decade or so, particularly in large urban communities. The Urban Institute gathers a lot of data on these kinds of things and shows that 501c3s, nonprofit organizations, have grown by 25% or so in the last decade across the nation.
Do you think that's a response to the Great Recession, and that there's greater need for assistance, so therefore they're responding to that? Or?
That probably is a bit of what's going on, I would imagine. I think there's some other kinds of nonprofits that appear to be shrinking over time. Business organizations that are nonprofits and so on. But 501c3s, the kind of community-based organizations that we think of, are growing. And it probably is in part at least due to the issues brought up by the Great Recession and cuts in services.
So what kinds of – I mean, what are we talking about when we say tax-exempt properties? I mean, I can think of a church right away. But give us examples.
Yeah, there are quite a few different kinds. The most common kinds in Michigan are religious organizations and their property holdings. K-12 school systems, of course, take up property in a city, but they don't pay taxes. Mm-hmm. One of the most common kinds of exemptions that really surprised us was principal residence exemptions for people in poverty. 47% of jurisdictions with exempt property have this kind. But then there's others. State and federal forest land in the Upper Peninsula and the Northern Lower Peninsula are take up an awful lot of land. Housing facilities for the elderly and disabled, nonprofit hospitals. So there's really a wide range of these things.
And I would suspect where you live in Michigan would kind of influence what types of tax-exempt properties are in your municipality.
That's right. Certainly up in the Upper Peninsula and the Northern Lower Peninsula, forest land is the most common. One thing that does stand out, though, is almost all kinds of these exempt properties other than forest land become more common as the size of the community increases. So religious properties are much more common in large jurisdictions than in some of our smallest ones.
Which totally stands to reason. Yeah,
exactly. K-12 districts and so on.
And then that would also then, I guess, influence the percentage of the land that you have in your municipality that has tax-exempt properties on it. So it's got to be very different if you're in a dense urban area versus the Upper Peninsula.
Yeah, it is. It is different. Although in some ways there are some commonalities. So one of the questions that we ask local leaders to try to get a gauge of this is how much of your property base is taken up by exempt properties, and it's highest in big jurisdictions. 48% say that these exempt properties take up a moderate or significant portion of their land. Although even in the smallest jurisdictions, 41%. Say that.
Okay. So there is that. So you're looking at, I'm sure, trying to get a sense of what the leaders see as the balance between what these groups can offer the community and what they take up in terms of resources. So what did you hear?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we found kind of mixed views by local leaders. And a lot of it depends on how much of this kind of property is in their jurisdiction. We asked how much is in the jurisdiction on three different measures, on the land base, on the amount of potential tax revenue that they could get, and on the sources of service demands that their jurisdictions face. And so we find different viewpoints based on different outcomes of those measures. Overall, local leaders are more likely to say that these taxes on properties are assets rather than liabilities to their fiscal health. That surprised us a little bit.
Why?
Well, so these different exemptions and the organizations that own them certainly can bring benefits to a community. Nonprofit hospitals deliver critical medical care and provide a lot of jobs. School systems give us more highly educated citizens and workers. Nonprofit cultural amenities like a museum may help bring tourists into the community. So there are some benefits that these things bring to their communities, even as they introduce financial costs because they're not paying the property taxes.
So again, looking at that balance and which outweighs the other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so local leaders are more likely to say that these things are assets overall to fiscal health than liabilities. But there are some tipping points there. And it goes back again to how common these exemptions are in a community. And so what we found is in those jurisdictions that say these exemptions take up a significant portion of their land mass, that asset liability gauge flips. Only 15% say that they're assets. 40% say that these are financial liabilities.
So what's the message here?
Well, I think the message is this is something to keep an eye on. As I say, there is evidence that these things are becoming more common as time goes by. We know that this is a time of great fiscal stress for a lot of local governments. And so if we continue to see more and more properties being taken off the tax rolls, I think we're going to start to see more discussion among local governments about looking for ways to boost revenues to make up for those losses.
On somebody's back.
That's
got to
right.
come from somewhere. Tom Evacco, Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy at the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Thanks so much for talking with us, Tom.
Thanks, Cindy.
Drive through cities like Detroit, Pontiac, Flint, and there it is in the most expected and unexpected places, graffiti. And there's the constant question, graffiti, is it blight and a nuisance or is it art? Does it signal signs of culture and revival? Or is it that black and white? Nancy Derringer explored these questions in a recent article for Bridge Magazine. Welcome, Nancy.
Great to be here, Cindy.
It seems there probably is not a lot of middle ground over the graffiti discussion. I mean, I'm guessing that people either think it's a very cool expression of art or they're appalled at what they see as a sign of decay.
I think that's very accurate. In fact, when I was writing this story, I found myself stopping periodically, trying to search for the right verb to describe who these folks even are, because I think some of them are undeniably artists. Some of them are undeniably vandals, and some of them kind of fall in between. So it's tough to find a middle ground or even a neutral verb for them.
And then when you have these post-industrial, when you get these post-industrial urban areas like we see in Detroit or in Flint, that has got to be sheer heaven if you want to do graffiti or, as you say, vandal. It could be artist or it could be vandal, depending on your point of view. But what a canvas for them.
Well, sure. And we have this, you know, we have thousands of buildings that have been either abandoned or shuttered or otherwise are not in use anymore and are falling into disrepair. When you talk to people who are kind of graffiti boosters or, you know, street art, which is what they call it, you know, they point out, how is what I am doing to this building worse than what the owner did to this building by walking away from it and leaving it to fall into disrepair? To them, this is an invitation, and they're taking it. It's a real kind of push me, pull you thing. It's a, well, this was part of my city, and you walked away from it, and now I'm going to claim it.
Now, you actually found there are different categories of graffiti. Can you kind of go into that for us and enlighten us?
Well, there's, you know, there's people who do, probably at the top end of the scale, you would see people who are good artists, who are technically skilled and can do these large, you know, pieces, they call them, these mural type pieces, like you might see in Detroit's Eastern Market or on the DeQuinder Cut, which is a recreation trail that runs through downtown.
Yes.
And the DeQuinder Cut was actually a renegade graffiti spot for many years before the railroad tracks were taken up and it was turned into this recreation trail. And so the decision was made to leave a lot of those pieces intact. And so you have that at kind of one end. And then at the other end, you would probably have the guy who goes around with a Sharpie or a single can of black spray paint and just paints his name on everything. You know, you might call those people taggers. And in between, you have kind of everybody else. And, you know, it's interesting because the standard thing for graffiti artists, vandals, whatever you want to call them, to do is their name, you know, their tag, their street name, whatever they call themselves. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to a guy who knows quite a lot about this, and he pointed out a tag that was right outside of his office window, and he goes, "That's what we call Detroit style." And I said, "Well, what's Detroit style?" And he said, "Well, it's very elaborate. There are multiple colors in it. Somebody took a lot of time to do this." And that's something that you can get away with in a city like Detroit, where the, you know, the police just don't have time to chase down kids who are,
true,
you know, who are doing this kind of thing. Everywhere else they would, you know, they're worried about what they call beating the buff, which is getting something down before the eradication teams come along and get rid of it.
Okay. I'm speaking with writer Nancy Derringer, talking graffiti. She looked into the graffiti issue in a recent edition of Bridge Magazine, and basically the question comes down, is this a blight and a nuisance, or is it really art and signs of culture and revival? And I'm interested, Nancy, if you're looking for people who regard graffiti as legit street art, who are these supporters? Is there anyone outside of the artists themselves?
Well, yeah, there's if you come to Detroit, there's a man named Derek Weaver who is promoting something that he's calling the Grand River Creative Corridor, which is a section of Grand River, I think it's between Warren and Rosa Parks, that they're trying to revitalize. And he has specifically invited some of the better known Detroit graffiti artists to come in and put up, you know, large scale murals, not just tags, not just mm-hmm. your name or whatever, but I mean big, elaborate street art pieces. And, you know, to him, he said this is a signifier to a certain type of urban individual that we're trying to attract to Detroit, you know, young, I don't want to say hipster, that's such a cliche, but
it
you
is.
Know, generally yeah. younger people who are looking for an urban experience that is not from the suburb that they were born and grew up in. Mm. And so to them, you know, a really nice piece of street art, you know, kind of tells them, "Hey kid, you're not living in Grosse Pointe anymore." Whereas undeniably, if you drive through areas of, like, you know, the Midtown area, what we used to call the Cass Corridor, there's an awful lot of just grungy vandalism around there too. And I don't know if people like that they are. Or not. It's not my cup of tea, but there you go.
You spoke to a really interesting person for this story who's a Flint lawyer who's also a graffiti writer. Tell us more about him, because he's a real bridge between the street life and the establishment.
He really is. His name is Charles Boyke. He's, I believe, 30, and he was a teenage graffiti thug, or I shouldn't say thug, he was a vandal, you know, and he admits that he was his mother was an artist and he had some artistic talent, and he said his story is the same as everybody's who does this. Some friend of his took him to an underpass with some paint and they started tagging, and he did this for a while, and eventually he got arrested, and I think he was put on some sort of probation. He moved to Chicago. He enrolled in art school, and then he enrolled in law school, and now he is a lawyer who still can paint. And he has started a festival called Aerosol and Audio, which is kind of music and graffiti in Flint in the summer. And what they do is they erect like a whole long line of like 4x8 sheets of plywood. And anybody can come in and paint wherever they want. And he really is the bridge. I mean, he talks about what they call permissible walls, which is a strategy that some cities are trying, where they're saying, okay, if you guys just can't stop yourselves, then at least do it here. and of course, you know, there's something in the ethos of graffiti that says, hey, if it's permissible, it's not graffiti.
It's not edgy
illegal.
Enough. In fact, speaking of illegal, I don't know if it's a matter of being illegal or not, but certainly Flint Mayor Dane Walling, you got the sense, is truly not a fan. What was his quote? "All the graffiti in Flint is being treated as a blight problem." How do they keep ahead of the graffiti writers?
Well, he said, you know, they've got some strategy. He said the one thing about graffiti is what makes a piece valuable is the more eyes that see it in the course of a day, the better. And so, you know, I guess probably the ultimate graffiti would be like on a high-rise building that like thousands of people pass under and have to look at. But I
sure.
think that's what's behind some of the overpass sign tagging. But, you know, what they do in Flint is, he said, they've taken some, you know, traditional hot spots and turn those over to community groups to do murals. And he said, generally speaking, the taggers will respect a mural, you know, another artist's work more than they would, say, a, you know, bridge abutment. That's one thing they do. But otherwise, you know, they have a volunteer squad and, you know, they just go out there with their white paint and they paint over it. So, I mean, it's really, it's kind of the ultimate Sisyphean task, if, you know, if I can use a little grad student word there. But, I mean, you know, you do it and then you have to do it again and you have to do it again. But that to them is the way they choose to deal with it. It's a... it's kind of like the broken window theory of crime prevention. You know, if you let it take hold, it tends to blight the whole area. So we always police it.
Do you get the sense that this too shall pass? Is this a fad, or do you think graffiti on city walls and overhead freeway signs is really here to stay?
I think it's here to stay. It's been around an awful long time. I think of it, there are two metaphors that work for me when you think of graffiti. One is tattoos and the other is hip hop. You know, when I was a kid, the only people who got tattoos were sailors and disreputable people who ran, you know, carnival rides or whatever at the state fair. You know, you didn't, it was a signifier that you were a rebel. And now, you know, your granddaughter probably has a tattoo somewhere and she doesn't care what her grandmother thinks about it. You know, the other is hip hop. I mean, hip hop was an art form that kind of came up from the streets. You know, when it first started to be heard on a widespread basis, you had people saying, that's not music, that's noise. Those guys can't play instruments. Who are, you know, what is this? And now, you know, it's everywhere. It's used in advertising and it's become a respected art form. I mean, these kids who are slinging spray cans on the corner may not have gone to art school, but you know, if little by little, if they work at it, they can kind of get good at it. And now you see graffiti. I mean, as Charles Boyke pointed out, he said, every time I see graffiti style lettering in an advertisement, you know, I think, well, we won. So there you go.
Writer Nancy Derringer explored graffiti in a recent edition of Bridge Magazine. Thanks so much, Nancy. Always good to talk with you.
Always great to be here, Cindy. Thanks.
So what do you think? Well, we are already hearing from you on Facebook. John Thompson writes, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and that can be said of ugly, too. Gabriel Field says, art is for the masses, power to the people. Let us know what you think. You can find us on Facebook or on Twitter. Of course, we're at Stateside Radio. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tenniskatter, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.